for us, relationships are an ingredient. And so, like, we really want to know the people and not just the food that they grow. You know, I think that, like, after visiting some of these vegetable farmers and visiting grain farmers, it's shocking to me how much effort goes into creating food from both, like, the human perspective and from the soil perspective. And so, like, we really want to make sure that we're honoring the work and the labor that these people are putting in to feed us and our community.
Welcome to the 381st installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. When Chris McLeod was working as a baker in California over a decade ago, he was frustrated that he couldn't source locally wheat and other grains that went into the flour he was working with. So he moved to Minnesota. After all, there's a reason Minneapolis is nicknamed Mill City. Processors that were headquartered on the banks of the Mississippi there had a deep history of gathering small grains from farms across the upper Midwest and transforming them into the flour that went into countless loaves of bread and other baked goods over the years. Imagine his surprise upon arriving in the Twin Cities only to discover that very little locally raised grain was being used by local bakers. And over the decades, small grains have disappeared from the rotations of many farmers in the region, making the idea of local flour almost an impossibility. But Chris was undeterred and remained committed to sourcing not only his grains, but also other ingredients such as vegetables locally. So, over the years, he set out to develop relationships with area farmers. Launa Bread, the bakery he and his partner Tiff Singh operate in South Minneapolis, now sources flour from businesses like Bakersfield Flour and Bread, a company in northeast Minneapolis that gets its grains from small and medium-sized farmers in the region. Chris and Tiff have also forged direct relationships with individual farmers. Chris says these relationships have had a profound impact on how he views the food system, all the way down to farming's impact on soil health. These relationships are being built at a time when there's renewed interest on the part of Midwestern farmers to integrate small grains into their rotations as a way to build soil health and diversify their income stream. In fact, I first met Chris at a Bringing Small Grains Back to Minnesota meeting LSP held for farmers in Madison, Minnesota this past summer. I was impressed with his commitment to building a business that stands by its principles of supporting farmers that are using methods that build economic and environmental resiliency. I recently stopped by Launa Bread's storefront on East Lake Street to talk to Chris about how a small business puts its money where its mouth is, how working with dough can be therapeutic, and how attending social gatherings in Germany inspired the name of his bakery. Chris, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about an important link in the food chain, the local food chain that you serve here with your bakery. But first, can you just give me a little background? How did you come from a bakery, is it in your genetics or is it in your background of some sort? Or how did you kind of get into this? What little bit of your background there?
I was not much of a cook or a baker growing up. The most that I would bake was a box of blueberry muffins or like a box of cookie dough. I studied abroad in Munich, and when I was in Munich, I really fell in love with the bakeries and the array of breads that each bakery had, and eventually made some friends there, and one of them, her family owns a bakery in a small town, and I was visiting them. Her dad is the head baker, and her mom runs the front of house. And I really appreciated the relationship they had with each other and with their work. And I sort of realized they had a quality of life that interested me. And my dad was grumpy a lot growing up, coming home from work, and he worked in finance. And I didn't really see from him like something that I wanted to emulate. And so visiting this baking family and seeing them excited to show me the things they're baking and the tools for their bakery and their relationship with their daughter, my peer, I was like interested in doing what they did, because I saw something that a 50-year-old married couple still had excitement about. And so after I graduated college, I found a job at a bakery in Portland, Oregon, which was my first really time baking. And so I've been baking since then, and that was about 13 years ago.
I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that transition into, you had been working for somebody else and learning the ropes, that must have been quite a switch, I would think. Maybe to start up and you're running your own business, you have to get up quite early, I assume, and all of that.
I worked at a handful of bakeries, and the first bakery I worked at, I learned how to bake bread but didn't understand what I was doing. I could read a recipe, and I could make the dough from that recipe and shape, but I didn't really understand the process. And eventually, the more bakeries I worked at and the more breads and pastries and styles I worked with, the more I understood the process of mixing and fermentation and the whole shebang. And I got to a point where I was working in California. We were using all local ingredients except for flour because California is not really a grain-growing state. A lot has changed, I think, in the last 10 years since I left California, and now it's becoming more accessible to get California or West Coast local grains. But I moved to Minnesota because I wanted to source the main ingredient in bread and in croissants and pastries from farmers. And so I moved here without ever visiting, just knowing that it was Mill City, and that it was a big grain-growing state. And when I moved here in 2014, I was a little bit surprised to find that there wasn't a local grain economy, and learning that most of the grains that are grown here are sold in commodity markets, and that most of the wheat goes to, like, South Korea. Or a specific type of red wheat goes to South Korea. And so I got a job working at Rustica, where I met Tiff. But when I was working at Rustica, when I had free time, I was really trying to find sources and, like, connections. And eventually I found Mark Askegaard outside of Moorhead. And he has 800 acres, I think, that he grows on, and about half of that is wheat. And he has a small mill, and so he was willing to sell me 300 pounds or 500 pounds, and that was sort of like the catalyst to be able to start a small bakery. I don't think I would have started this business if I couldn't find local flour. That was sort of like the primary reason I wanted to do this. And started working with Mark in 2015 when I first opened the bakery, and so he was delivering flour to me, and then I would drive to Lonesome Stone Milling and Lone Rock to pick up sifted white flour from Gilbert's to bring back. And so those were my two relationships that I started building. And almost 10 years later, we still purchase flour that is grown by Mark and his daughter Beth. We also buy grains directly from Mark and his daughter that Bakersfield doesn't use for their own milling. And it's a really wonderful relationship to have with these farmers, to have a connection with, like, where we're getting our food, and also to see how important it is for them to have a connection to people making food from what they grow.
I'm sorry, I got to go back. I think that's hilarious that you came here, because that's what the Twin Cities is known as, Mill City, you know, Minneapolis, right there. For folks who aren't familiar with, you go to the river and you see the old remnants of the mills, the General Mills and Pillsbury and all that. And so that is very much part of our legacy. But that must have been quite a surprise to find out, oh, it isn't like there's a bunch of farmers running around selling selling grain to local bakers and flour processors, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think really one of the first challenges I discovered, which we still have, is quantity that we can use or purchase. You know, we are a small bakery and we use 30,000 pounds of grain a year currently. And that equates to, I think, 16 acres. So when Mark is growing 400 acres, you know, we're not even using like 10% of what he's growing. And so obviously he's not selling directly. Most of what he's doing is not selling directly to us. He sells most of his linker that he grows to Bakersfield, and we purchase from them. But for example, last year, Mark grew Noreen wheat and couldn't find a buyer or a local buyer, and wanted to see if we would use any before he sold it to the commodity food system or organic commodity food system. And it was sort of this conversation of how much of that crop can we realistically use. You know, 30,000 pounds of flour that we use, we're not going to convert everything to that one. And so we bought a super sack, which is about 2,200 pounds, and then we really enjoy it, so we bought the rest that he had remaining on his farm after selling. So then we bought another 800 pounds, and this year we're going to probably buy 5 super sacks, so like 10 to 12,000 pounds of Noreen wheat from him. But I think that, like, we want to support these farmers as much as we can, but, like, realistically, as a small bakery, we can't purchase a lot of a small grain farm. You know, a small grain farm is still a very large operation compared to what we can bake and what we can sell.
Have you noticed just in the last 10 years more, I guess, is it a little bit easier to access? There are more farmers out there raising some of these small grains, especially the specialty small grains?
Yeah, I would say so. Bakersfield Flour and Bread, which is in northeast Minneapolis, they opened up, in 2016, and they definitely made it easier. You know, as I said, I was buying flour from Mark that he would mill, but that was also in a limited scope. And so once Bakersfield opened up, it allowed other farmers access to a mill or an access to a market that was milling it so that more bakeries or pasta shops or home bakers could access it. And so I think that it is easier to get specialty crops or specialty small grains. I think that generally speaking, it is hard to find the more expensive varieties. So like spelt, emmer, einkorn, durum, kamut, those ones aren't really available locally. I think part of it is everything is based off of, or prices are based off of yields. And so conventional grains might cost, I'm making numbers up, but 50 cents, and organic is about, yields about half as conventional. So then it's a dollar per pound. And then if you're growing an heirloom variety or something, it might yield half as much as organic, so now you're paying $2 a pound. And so we would like to, in small quantities, use like spelt or kamut or coruscant or some other grains, but it's a risk for these farmers to take in the first place because they haven't grown it before. And so they're sort of discovering, will this work on their field? But also for them, the cost of the seed to plant for that risk is also higher than the cost of what they have, which most often they're saving their own seed to plant the next year.
Do you ever approach a farmer before the season and say, so we're looking for a certain amount of this kind of wheat or whatever, you know, could you plant? We would guarantee you we would buy a certain amount. Do you do that kind of planning ahead or not?
Yeah, we have done that with Mark Asgard, and it's more of a question or a curiosity of asking if him or his daughter have ever grown like a variety of wheat before, such as Rouge de Bordeaux, and send them information about it, and then it piques their interest. And so they have done a little bit of experimentation 2 years ago with all the rain. Their 20 acres washed away. They grew some this year. I don't know what the quality is like, but I think it is really cool as a small bakery to have some agency in this, and that like we have relationship with farmers in a generally commodity food system, and that these farmers are interested in ways to support us, even though we can't buy the whole crop that they'd be growing. But I think it, in a way, it sort of like allows them to consider additional markets for some more specialty varieties of wheat, for example.
I think that's a good point. They could maybe raise a couple acres for you of this, something they've never raised before, and if it works out, they're like, oh, okay, maybe that's something I can integrate into my rotation on a bigger scale.
Yeah, I agree. This year, Mark and his daughter, Beth, are growing, or did grow, I think, 1 to 2 new varieties of wheat that they've never grown before. And last year they grew Noreen, which was the first year they grew that. And part of it is also discovering that like Noreen, which is a winter wheat, is also helpful for the crop rotation because a winter wheat they plant in the fall and it stays in all winter and long. And it's, you know, for them having something planted in the ground all year round is important. And so they sort of like found that that is actually a good crop for them for their crop rotation and soil management. And so they grew it again another year. And so now I don't know if they'll continue growing it based off of their market to sell it, but I think in a way they're discovering that like experimenting and trying to find new grains to grow is expanding their ability to manage their soil health.
Wow, I really love that connection. I mean, it's the term win-win is used too much, but and abused. But that's a win-win. Like you find something that your customers want or that you're want to work with, and then it benefits their rotation and their soil health. One of the things I got to say is you've already in the last couple minutes mentioned varieties of wheat I had never even heard of, and I thought I was somewhat familiar with some of these. I guess school me a little bit on why we would need so many different varieties. This is so different than the conventional raw commodity system of agriculture, where you're raising the same varieties, you know, it's going to be corn or beans. That's your decision right there. This is so nuanced the way this kind of relationship you have with some of these farmers. But from a baker's standpoint, why do you need, what are, you don't have to go through everything, but why would one variety maybe be different that you're working with than another as far as, I suppose, flavors, that kind of thing?
I think that generally, like, we as a food culture have misunderstood commodity crops, and that you think that corn is just corn and that wheat is just wheat, but they are just like tomatoes, where there's heirloom varieties and there are modern varieties, and there's dozens of names, and the University of Minnesota and NDSU and all these universities are developing new varieties of wheat and different grains for disease and pest tolerance, for climate change, for yield. And so at our bakery, we use, these are varieties of wheat, Linkert, Rough Rider, Forefront, and Noreen. And that's not including all of the other grains that we purchase, like rye and barley and more. But they all have different baking properties. And so we buy them all sort of like identity preserved. So like when we buy a bag of flour, we're buying a bag of Mark Askegaard's whole wheat Noreen. Or we're buying Luke Peterson's sifted Rough Rider. At the bakery, we are blending them to create characteristics for us to have flavorful bread that has a good rise to it, has good fermentation. So grains can affect the whole process of baking. And so some of them will have a nice rise to them. Some grains or wheat varieties will ferment too fast and then eventually just like collapse before they're ready to go in the oven. Some of them have nuttier flavors. Some of them can be a bit sweeter or bitter. Some of them, when you mill them, can be a bit more coarse because they might be a bit harder. And so there's a lot of different properties. And when you're buying a bag of gold medal flour or anything from the grocery store, that's going to be the same whether you buy it today or in 10 years or 10 years ago, because they have cereal scientists at these facilities to test each variety of grain from each farm. Their goal is to make sure that it performs exactly the same way every single day of the year. And so when you're buying a bag of flour, it's very far away in your mind from what it actually is. And like when I first started baking, I was using flour every day, but I realized I have no idea what wheat looks like, you know? Like And then I had to go to a farm and I was like, oh, this is the actual ingredient. It's not just a powder. I would say that we are trying to sort of like bridge that, like that thing that we all lost. Right. You know, like we have like wheat in our bakery that you can see. We also try to educate our customers because every year, even though we buy the same varieties of wheat, the harvest will create a different baking characteristic. Mm. So we could buy Linkert this year, which we will do, but we're going to have to redo our recipes because the time of year, the heat, everything within the growing conditions are going to change the properties of it. It is going to be the same throughout the whole year. And then once the new harvest year comes in, we have to rewrite our recipes, which in some cases is very easy and in some cases can be challenging. But it's exciting because it makes us actually like think about what we're doing. Baking is a very repetitive process. Every day I do the same thing. But if I do the same thing with something that has a little bit of challenge to it, I get to consider how I'm working, like really working with these ingredients, and how I can like really like adjust different parts of the processes to create something successful with something that is very inconsistent in the realm of the baking world.
That's fascinating. I remember when I ran into you at the small grains meeting we had in Madison, Minnesota this summer, that you talked about how baking can be boring. You know, just the job of baking itself, but this has added a little bit of interest to you that you have to kind of be on your toes a little bit and adjust.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that in a way we make baking not boring by making it incredibly challenging. I think that we have to think a lot more about each step of the process, and it requires a lot more intuition. I've been making the same bread for 10 years. It's changed a lot in 10 years. When I first started making it, it was with Gilbert's sifted flour and Mark's whole wheat flour, and now it is with Mark's whole wheat flour and Luke Peterson's sifted flour, and then also we've added rye and barley into it, and the hydration has changed, the ratio of the different flours has changed to try to make the same loaf every year. And when we have these transitional periods, which is typically now in like September, October, when Patrick at Bakersfield mentions that the 2024 harvest is all used up, and that 2025 is clean and dry and they're milling it. We have like a transition period in the bakery where we might have to tell our customers that right now the bread looks a little bit different or it tastes a little bit different because we have these fresh unknown ingredients that in a way look exactly the same, but when you start mixing them you might notice that the bread is really dense or stiff or there's too much elasticity or it's too extensible, which those two words are like a slinky. So extensibility is pulling the slinky outwards, okay. And then elasticity is when you release it and it comes back together. And so those are the main properties in bread or gluten that allow you to have a loaf that rises, holds its shape, but continues to grow.
God, that, I keep saying this word, but that is, I find that really fascinating. It reminds me a little bit of, say, a CSA who's providing vegetables to eaters, members of the farm, that sometimes they have to explain, well, the tomatoes are going to be this way because we had a weather situation or we had this happen. And so it's a way for people, frankly, to be more in touch with their food. I think that's really important. And speaking of customers, like who are your customers? I know you have a storefront retail place here on Lake Street, so I suppose you have walk-in but do you have other customers? And I'm also interested in how important, these aren't folks who are just going to go pick up their loaf of bread, their Wonder Bread, wherever at the grocery store. They obviously care very much about kind of this artisanal type bread and baked products, bakery products. But who are these folks talking to you a little bit about how it's raised, or are you talking to them about it, or, you know, obviously flavor's number one, or that's not going to bring them back, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think besides the ingredients that we use, which are, for the most part, local organic ingredients from small farms, our bread is also all sourdough, and we also incorporate a lot of whole grains and a diversity of grains into our breads. So our staple loaf, which is called bread, is 67% whole grain flour, and of the whole grain it's mostly whole wheat, but there's also barley and rye in it. And so part of that is trying to diversify what we purchase from farms so that we're not just a monocrop like wheat supporting bakery, but also having a diversity of grains is good for your gut health. And I think that a lot of our customers come here because they trust what we're doing in our practices and our sourcing, but they also have a different experience when they eat bread. Mm-hmm. They don't experience inflammation or like a heaviness in their gut, or they might have like some sensitivity to wheat or gluten, but are able to eat the things that we make here. So there's definitely a lot of folks that come in because they want to eat bread that they consider to be healthy for them, which is what we make here. And then we also have people that come here because they prioritize local food systems and want to support people that are championing that. And so for them, they find it like really wonderful to come here and feel that there's a connection to local agriculture, which is not just like the wheat and the grains that we're purchasing, but also we use a lot of seasonal food here from farms within 1 to 2 hours in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it'll, you know, sometimes we'll have a pastry that is around for 2 weeks because the harvest was bad. You know, like last year we had a plum pastry, and I think we had it for 7 days because the plum tree only had like 12 pounds of plums on it. And the year before it had 100 pounds. And so it's one of those things where we're trying to emphasize, like, everything is not available all the time. Impermanence is, like, a good thing because you can savor it and you get to wait until next year for this, like, wonderful thing to show up again. And then we have customers that just live in the neighborhood that came in, and I think they, you know, they discovered us and they discovered what we do and appreciate the local sourcing and how we show up within the community. And so I think a lot of it is local customers, and then people that drive further are the ones that are concerned about wanting to eat bread that supports their digestion.
I looked at your website, and you have a page that's really impressive that shows the source of your ingredients. And it's not just the grains. It's even vegetables, that type of thing, that are going into it. But can you just give us a picture of how many farmers in a year's time you might be working with and the different ingredients besides the grains that you might be? Just a rough idea, if you can remember.
That's a hard question, but we purchase all of our wheat flour from Bakersfield, and additionally we buy some grain directly from the Askagards that Bakersfield mills. All of our non-wheat grains, such as rye, barley, buckwheat, and the seeds like sunflower, gold, or brown flax, those come from whole grain milling. And then, I mean, there's Aerolumista, Cloverby, Growing Lots, Racing Heart, Mary Dirty Face, Little Hillberry Farm, Autumnwood Farm, Eichton's, Lowry Hill Provisions. There's some more, Carmen and Peter, Foxtail Farm. There's a handful of farms that we purchase from, and a lot of these farms that we work with are people that we met working at farmers markets back in the day. And a lot of these people are, you know, like, we worked with them, and, like, we had successful farmers markets together, or we had farmers markets that got rained out. But we also got to know each other as people, and we got to see each other's, like, work ethic and what they're growing on their fields. And so for us, relationships are an ingredient. And so, like, we really want to know the people and not just the food that they grow. And there's a lot of deep respect in the work from the farmers that we source from. And I think there's also a lot of respect in the way that we try to turn their food, the raw ingredients, into, like, a beautiful pastry or bread, and also to know that we're trying to reduce waste, and so that what they're growing is not also just going in the garbage can. You know, I think that, like, after visiting some of the vegetable farmers and visiting grain farmers, it's shocking to me how much effort goes into creating food from both, like, the human perspective and from the soil perspective. And so, like, we really want to make sure that we're honoring the work and the labor that these people are putting in to feed us and our community.
Well, and speaking of community, I know community is very important to you in other ways. You really try to support folks, you know, who aren't getting enough to eat, that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it sort of started with COVID, which we started doing a pay what you can system, and we sort of discovered that, like, within our community, or like the people that we know, most folks had the means, and so we were getting a lot of people donating to us. And so we started reaching out to different organizations to do like a significant or a large bake to deliver 100 or 200 loaves, and to deliver them fresh and have it be intentional and not as an afterthought. And so, you know, in the past 5 years, we've been continually doing that. Right now, we do one or two large bakes throughout the year, but then every week we're also donating bread to a local church that does soup for you, which is soup and bread, I think 5 days a week. And it's really appreciated there, and it's really appreciated that they're receiving fresh bread, that they like wait for it to show up that day to slice it for their meal. But we think it's really important that providing food for people without the means to purchase it is something that is fresh and thought of for them, not as a way to get rid of pastries at the end of the day.
That's a good point, because that often happens. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, we got this waste product. So yes. Kind of not very respectful of those folks, yeah. You know, as far as just treating them as an afterthought. I wanted to back up on one thing. You have to juggle a lot of balls in the air as far as accessing your ingredients. And that is a big problem that whenever we talk about localizing the food system, building a community-based food system, is juggling all those balls. Transportation is a big one, because that's why the conventional food system dominates, is it's got this very efficient system relying on cheap petroleum products to get stuff from point A to point B, to the point where there's some ludicrous situations where sometimes it's cheaper to ship in tomatoes from California than to access local tomatoes here in Minnesota or whatever. But how do you juggle all the kind of the logistics of accessing this stuff and kind of connecting with folks? And it must be a little bit crazy sometimes.
Yeah, it can feel a bit crazy. We have a lot of different people delivering throughout the week. We don't just have, like, one big truck with everything. And so, especially in the summer and the fall, we are getting emails or texts from a dozen farmers with what they have available, and trying to sort of coordinate, like, what we can take in and how much time we have to process. Because for us, it's a lot of labor to clean and chop and roast and process all of these raw foods that we're most people can just buy in a can. But, you know, we work with the farmers and their systems, and so we get the deliveries on the days that they're coming into the Twin Cities, like dropping off their CSAs or dropping off to other accounts, and we try to give them all the heads up that they need. I know a lot of times there's poor communication from chefs, you know, asking for tomatoes at midnight for the next day. And we really try to never do that. You know, we try to, like, understand the needs of the farmers, just as when people come to us and ask us for a large order the next day, we say no. because we within how we do our baking system here. So we, you know, we really like work with the farmers and like what they have available and when they can deliver it. And if there's no availability, then we just don't offer that. You know, we are a very flexible bakery, and so we can change our menu based off of what comes in at the door.
What's the future look like? Are you kind of, is this kind of the trajectory you're on, or have you thought about some other changes? Is there anything I guess exciting out there? You must be a little bit excited about, there does seem to be a growing interest in small grains and people eating healthy. That's been a thing that's been around for a few years, but I don't know. Just in general, what are you thinking?
I think that this is sort of it. I don't think that we have any plans to open a second location or to add more days of the week. I think in the future, adding baking classes, you know, we have a lot of folks that are interested in learning how to bake with whole grains. And that is something that we just haven't really found the time or energy to work on. You know, we might offer like a pizza night one day a week, but part of Tiff and I's role here or desire to be here is to be in the dough. You know, it's like be a part of the process. Like part of our job is to manage, and it'll always be to manage, but we also want to be connected to what we set out doing. And so we don't want to grow into a business where Tiff and I show up and are just doing office work and managing people all day. We still want to show up and be part of the process and be part of that like boring repetition. But like that is like for me a form of meditation. And so the more time I spend away from baking, the less time I get my meditation. So it's sort of like a juggling act of how can I get all the office work done and also stay connected to the work that we're doing to feed people. I mean, I think, you know, there's just always new opportunities that arise, whether it is a new vegetable that we discover or a new way to use an existing vegetable, I guess, or recently attended a USDA corn and maize event. And it was nixtamalizing and trying to find different varieties of corn for tortillas. And I got a hand on Montana Murado, which is a purple corn. And we were making brioche with a purple corn mash in it. And it was like the most exciting thing I ever did. I can't find a local source for that. And so I'm working with somebody to try to find the connection to somebody that would be interested in growing a small crop of Montana Murado. But I think it's just like little things like that of, you know, somebody shows up and they're like, hey, I have this variety of corn or a grain, or I have this eggplant or something. And then we workshop it and we see if it's successful or not. And it's hard because sometimes we'll make something that we think is really wonderful, but it's just a little bit too far for like the ritual of coming to a bakery and getting like a fruit Danish. Uh-huh. You know, like some things are like really wonderful, but it's beyond somebody's desire when they come for like their ritual of getting like what they really just want or what they know they can expect to be good.
You like to experiment and you want to be creative, but you got to still sell the product too.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And you know, sometimes it's just, or the only way is by discovering. So Laune is a German word.
Oh yeah.
It means mood or whim or vibe. And when I was living in Munich and my friends invited me to a party, I would ask, what can I bring? Their response was, bring nur deine gute Laune, which is just bring your good vibes. And so, you know, working in this bakery, like I mentioned, like the meditation is like the bread reflects our moods. So when we're taking it out of the oven, we can see if we are paying attention and clear-headed, if we're rushing or patient. You know, it creates a lot of gute Laune or good vibes, and it's something that it creates every day we're baking. And then also like creating those relationships with customers and with these farmers, it's a lot of like positivity and like these like learning how like what we're doing is supporting other people, or how this loaf of bread somebody purchased reminds them of their grandmother's bread that was baked in Europe or anywhere in America. And so it's, I think what we do here is really special, and it feels really wonderful to feel connected to both the ingredients and the people, both that walk in the door, the front door, and the people that walk through the back door doing deliveries.
During our conversation, Chris mentioned working with Gilbert Williams, who's considered the grandfather of local Midwestern milling. Episode 379 of Ear to the Ground features my conversation with Gilbert. For a link to that podcast and for more on how small grains can contribute to a diversified, economically vibrant farming system, See the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 381 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.